For our blind and print-impaired listeners, your North Carolina Reading Service brings you Indie Week of January the 19th, 2023. Hello, I am John Federson with this print and online edition. But before we dig in, let me offer a word of appreciation for today's musicians, and they number nearly three, I'm told. Thanks. And as they scurry out of the studio, let's get into the Indie Week. First up from IndieWeek.com, the online edition, which has some later Dateline news than the print edition. Durham City Council rejects huge housing development proposal from Falls Lake Watershed, a 4-2 vote. The contentious Kemp Road Project, 655 single-family houses and townhomes on 280 acres in the environmentally fragile Falls Lake Watershed, is dead, at least temporarily. But before sticking a fork in the proposal, Durham City Council members dug into several underlying issues vexing residents of one of the fastest-growing areas in the country, housing, gentrification, and race. Ultimately, the council voted down the rezoning that opponents said would have contributed to pollution in Lick Creek. That creek, 7 miles of which is on the federally impaired list, flows into Falls Lake, and in turn the lake feeds the Neuse River, which travels to Pamlico Sound and empties into the Atlantic Ocean. The tally, 4-2 against, with Mark Anthony Middleton and Leonardo Williams voting yes. Before his yes vote, Williams said, "We define very well what we're against, but not what we're for. I'm so sick and tired of us only being against and no plan going forward. This is a good project. We have a housing crisis. We have to choose people over deer." The proposal put forth by developers, Bethesda Associates of Cary, has been amended several times over the last 28 months, largely in response to city officials' concerns. Last summer, the Durham Planning Commission voted 11-0 to send an unfavorable recommendation to City Council, reported Policy Watch. That's, by the way, where this article originated, by Lisa Sorg. The developer agreed to widen parts of Highway 98, slightly reduce the number of homes, and add a few units of affordable housing, with about 19 of them devoted to buyers earning no more than 80% of the area median income. In addition to 300-foot stream buffers, well above the 50 feet that's legally required, the developer doubled the original amount of tree coverage and offered to donate 5.5 acres to the city for a park. The developer's attorney, Neil Ghosh, said, "The applicant has given you so many reasons to vote yes." None of these concessions, though, change the fact that a draft city planning document advises against new development in areas east of Kemp Road to the Wake County line until adequate infrastructure is built, and a significant part of the proposed project would lie in that zone. Nor have Durham officials figured out how to stem the flow of dirt into Lick Creek and Falls Lake, a drinking water supply for Raleigh. Parts of Falls Lake are also on the federally impaired waters list. Sediment, some of it running off cleared lots, is filling in parts of the lake and creek. That's important because excessive sediment can suffocate aquatic life and bury breeding areas in layers of mud. Sediment is also carrying harmful bacteria into Lick Creek and Falls Lake, burdening municipal water treatment systems that must remove those pathogens before sending water to residents' taps. Pam Andrews, who lives near the proposed development, belongs to Preserve Rural Durham, an opponent of the project. She noted that one of new comprehensive plan's goals is, quote, "to protect Durham's most sensitive areas. This has all of those factors." Durham has been lax in enforcing erosion and sedimentation rules in the Falls Lake watershed. A previous investigation by Policy Watch found that neighbors for years complained to the city and county about a property owner who illegally dumped dirt, gravel, and other unknown material on land near Falls Lake with impunity. Eventually, the state and county fined the owner, Russell Stout III, $100,000. However, because Stout did not pay the fine, it had to be forwarded to the state attorney's general's office for collection. In other parts of the watershed, the environmental damage continues. Neuse River keeper Samantha Kropp monitors the health of Lick Creek and Falls Lake. She presented recent photographs to council members showing coffee-colored, dirt-laden water leaving a drain pipe from a nearby property that is under development. That discharge is entering the creek. Durham's erosion and sedimentation rules aren't sufficient to control this runoff, said Kropp. But since the pollution is entering Lake Creek, that is a Clean Water Act violation. Kropp reported the incident to state regulators, who are investigating. Councilmember Jillian Johnson supported the project, but not in this spot. I want us to build townhouses in most parts of the city and have higher levels of environmental commitments. My problem is where this development is. We created policies with developing this region, and staff said not to build east of Kemp Road until we improve the infrastructure. We drew the line at Kemp Road, and we shouldn't walk back that policy. This is an excellent project, said Councilmember Javier Caballero, but if we say yes to this, it will create a domino effect in an area we're not ready to develop. Councilmember Ladidriana Freeman said she is frustrated by the lack of viable solutions to Durham's housing crisis. We have to make sure affordable housing isn't at the expense of clean water. Durham is short on housing, especially for low to moderate income households. Median rental prices have increased 4.5% over the past year, although they have begun to level off. The average rent for a two-bedroom is $1,400 a month, according to data from Apartment List. Home sales are also beginning to cool, but the average price is still over $370,000. With a 10% down payment, a household would still have to earn more than $100,000 annually to afford a home at that price. In a lengthy discussion, Middleton questioned whether neighbors opposed the project on environmental grounds or implicit racial and class bias. Middleton said, "For some people, preserve rural is a code word." He said, "especially for white people who don't want urban interlopers, non-white people, in their neighborhoods." Some people lose their deer. Some people lose their homes and have to pack up and go to Burlington or Mebane, said Middleton. We are managing the growth of an American city that's one of the hottest places to live. It's not easy. And another quick article, abridged, from NC Policy Watch. We've probably already heard on other sources. Attorney General Josh Stein has officially entered the 2024 race for the North Carolina governorship. Stein announced his run with a three-minute video on social media, pledging to fight for North Carolina's future. About 30 seconds of the ad is devoted to the incendiary rhetoric of Republican Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson, who is widely expected to make his own run. Robinson has called homosexuality filth, pushed for banning abortions, and said that men, not women, are called by God to leadership positions. A December poll of likely Republican voters showed Robinson with a strong lead over other possible GOP primary challengers, including former Governor Pat McCrory. Next, again from the online edition, Jasmine Gallup reports about Raleigh's crisis response team, the Acorns unit, and there to add about $800,000 from the year's budget to add positions to the high-need areas for these social work positions. In the past 18 months, Raleigh's crisis response team has helped track down the birth certificate for someone in order to help them get SNAP benefits, built a rapport with someone on a university campus showing concerning behaviors, and made connections with their family. and help transport someone panhandling on Glenwood Avenue get to their monthly medical care appointment. Raleigh Police Lieutenant Renee Lockhart, who commands ACORNS, which stands for Addressing Crises Through Outreach, Referrals, Networking, and Service. We understand the need to foster growth, patience, relationships, and understanding with our community. We are all passionate about what we do, and we're making sure we are seeing the people behind the homelessness, behind the mental health issues, and behind the substance use. Now, ACORNS will add a new social work supervisor and three new workers to its existing team of nine, according to a presentation from Lockhart at Raleigh City Council meeting on Tuesday. The City Council earmarked $800,000 for the expansions of ACORNS for the fiscal year 22-23. Now that the money has been allocated, the unit will outline the new positions and hire people to fill them. The three new social workers will be stationed in Raleigh's busiest districts, where the ACORNS unit has seen the most activity, downtown, southeast Raleigh, and north Raleigh. Some money will also be used to buy a data tracking system, said Lockhart. The system will help track the number of people with whom the unit comes in contact, as well as their backgrounds and needs. City Council members have also asked the unit to track the kinds of calls they respond to. For example, the number of encounters with people who are experiencing a mental health crisis. ACORNS, which began work in June of 2021, is currently focused on helping people dealing with homelessness, mental health concerns, and substance abuse issues. Team members work to connect people to the care they need. That team is composed of Lockhart, a police sergeant, a detective, three officers, and three social workers. After the new positions are filled, the team will expand from 9 to 13. Everyone wears civilian clothing rather than uniforms while on duty, said Police Chief Estella Patterson. The ACORNS unit has faced some criticism for its approaches to crisis intervention, which is different from some other programs where staff are dispatched through the 911 system. Specifically, the unit has drawn comparisons to Denver's STAR program, as well as Oregon's CAHOOTS program. Lockhart said during her presentation, "We are familiar with CAHOOTS, we're familiar with the STAR program." Before the launch of ACORNS, the research and planning unit took a lot of time to talk to these other departments, other agencies, and what they came up with is what's best for Raleigh. Detective Wendy Clark expanded on that point. When we started with the development of the unit, what we had envisioned turned out to be something very different from what we have now. She added the department was finding more success providing more of a wraparound service. We could respond to the 9/11 calls, but it's putting a Band-Aid on the problem. You're responding to the original crisis, Clark continued. What we're doing, we're coming in on the backside, making sure people are connected to resources and making sure they get from point A to point B, so there are not repeat calls for service. Right now, the ACORNS unit itself initiates calls for service, meaning members decide when and where they go out into the community. The unit monitors police radio and officers' dispatches, but they're not directed by 911 operators. Still, ACORNS does respond to 911 calls alongside officers and follows up with the people that officers encounter during their patrols. Patterson said, if there is a call where somebody that is in crisis or somebody that's dealing with a mental health issue, these individuals do respond to that. The officers know the routine by now. They'll call us up front and say, we need to have ACORNS respond to this call. The Raleigh Police Department also has a crisis intervention team with officers who are specifically trained to respond to mental health crises, as well as a negotiation unit which can respond to barricaded subjects and hostage situations, said Lockhart, who added that dispatching ACORNS through 9/11 may be an option for the future, as long as it's not taking away from the care navigation we're providing right now, she said. When we have the additional staff, we may be able to be dispatched to certain groups of calls that would be helpful to patrol officers. Acorn's team members spend most of their time out in the field, Lockhart said. From August 21 to December 22, they responded to more than 1,000 calls for service. The unit's top three requests were for follow-up investigations, for example, with people dealing with mental health issues or overdose, requests for transport to shelters, medical care, or other services, and searches for missing persons. During that time, the Acorns unit made contact with 546 people in need, secured 86 release of information forms, which helped them coordinate care, and accepted nearly 400 referrals from the RPD. Lockhart added the unit has been able to help 9 people find permanent housing and reconnect 7 people to their families. Raleigh's efforts to coordinate care and provide more services to people in need have drawn a lot of these people to the area. Lockhart said the majority of the folks we come in contact with are new to Raleigh. They're looking for resources. City staff says that was expected. City Manager Marshall Adams David says a lot of the folks on the regular roll now are people that have been dropped off at Moore Square or downtown, and it's not necessarily Raleigh natives. Our perspective is we provide help to whoever needs it. There's no picking and choosing. Acorns is also working on securing regular transport for people who need it, rather than just meeting their needs on a case-by-case basis with a limited staff. City Council members are working on creating a van service for the Acorns unit and social workers to use in partnership with the Downtown Raleigh Alliance, said Raleigh Mayor Mary Ann Baldwin. The Acorns unit is also working on buying 3 of its own vans and creating a mobile office. The biggest outstanding need for the people served by Acorns is predictably affordable housing. One of the social workers with the unit, Chelsea Levy, explained the number of vouchers which qualify people for discount or emergency housing far outnumbers the number of apartments and other units that are actually available. She says the bucket is full of vouchers, but there's nowhere to house them. There is almost no affordable housing in the city of Raleigh, so those vouchers are actually being recycled back to the housing authority, and those people are finding themselves still experiencing homelessness. Levy said she and others have been working with Wake County to find private landlords willing to help through the county's landlord engagement unit, but there's just not enough to go around. Levy often works with people who may have a criminal history, evictions, or poor credit, which makes it harder to find private landlords willing to rent to them. The wait list for vouchers is around 5 to 7 years, which means once people are forced to give them up, they could remain on the streets for a half decade or more. Vouchers can be extended for up to 120 days once issued, about 4 months, but after that, many people are out of luck. Levy said, a lot of people are having to turn back in their vouchers and get back on the wait list and just cross their fingers. They're on the street, in shelters, self-paying for hotels. I have a lot of contacts who have received disability checks every month, and they're using it up in a week and a half on hotels because it's cold. There's the White Flag shelter, but a lot of those who have been in shelters for years and years, they just don't want to return. Lastly, from Indie Week Online, Tomasi McDonald entered this story on January 13th. Afghan man killed 2 weeks after becoming U.S. citizen. Uber driver Anzagul Totakil was trying to live the American dream. Last month, a 40-year-old native of Afghanistan and married father of 7 children, 5 sons and 2 daughters, became an American citizen after moving to North Carolina in 2016. His cousin Yusuf Mangal told Indy this week he was very excited because his family was moving to the United States. He added that Totakil's wife is pregnant with their 8th child. Mangal said he and Todhakil both worked as interpreters for U.S. troops for more than a decade. He said they moved to North Carolina after they received immigration visas to escape the violence his country was enduring. Todhakil's dream turned into a nightmare on New Year's Eve when he was shot to death in East Durham where he was working. Talk about a cruel irony. Todhakil and his cousin chose to live in North Carolina because most of their American friends were stationed at Fort Bragg. He escaped the horrific violence in his own country, only to be slain by gunfire in East Durham. Mangal said, "Unfortunately, it happened to us here in America. This is a crazy world." It was just after 10:55 p.m. when police responded to reports of a shooting on Holloway Street near South Adams. When the officers arrived, they found Todhakil inside of his vehicle, mortally wounded. Emergency workers pronounced the Uber driver dead at the scene. Investigators have not disclosed a motive for the shooting, but they say it was not random. Mangal said he became a U.S. citizen 2 weeks before he was killed. He dreamed of his kids becoming citizens and was excited about his kids getting a better education. Education is a mess in Afghanistan. No one is going to school, especially the girls. 1 year before arriving in the U.S., fighting between the Taliban and government forces, Mangal's and Todhakil's homeland had escalated, according to Human Rights Watch. Quote, "The upsurge in violence had devastating consequences for civilians with suicide bombings, improvised explosive devices, and target attacks by the Taliban and other insurgents, causing 70% of all civilian casualties. The number of civilians killed during government military operations, particularly ground offensive, increased too," reported Human Rights. Mangal said it was about 4:50 a.m. when police called and told him his cousin had been fatally shot in his vehicle in Holloway Street. He called his cousin's family, who had been living at a U.S. military base in Qatar. He said Todhakil last saw his family about 3 months ago when he traveled to Afghanistan, helped them secure green cards, and brought them to Qatar on October 18th. Mangal told Indy, "There was crying, pain, a lot of grief and sorrow." Mangal said he last spoke with his cousin about 3 or 4 hours before he was killed. I told him to come join us for dinner. He said he was in Apex dropping off a last fare and was going to Kerry for another fare. There was a lot of work because it was New Year's night. Mangal on January 4 set up a GoFundMe page to help pay for funeral expenses and to help his family with expenses when they arrive in America. So far, about 1,400 people have donated $64,000 toward the goal of $80,000. On the GoFundMe page, Mangal described his cousin as, quote, "a devoted family man loved by community, friends, and family, who has left behind a wife and 7 children without any bread earner now." He told Indy that Todhakil's family will use the funds to find a house when they arrive in the States and purchase furniture. "They deserve it," he said about his cousin's wife and children. Todhakil's funeral took place Friday at the Jamaat Ibir al-Rahman Masjid on Fayetteville Street in Durham. Mangal said, "We dreamed the American dream, except it's my dream now. He's gone. His family will pursue the American dream." Now, we're in the print issue of Indie Week, and Lisa Sorg, who penned that first article from Online Edition, has one called Falling Short about the North Carolina Utilities Commission. Around 6 o'clock on the evening of Friday, December 30th, when anyone who could be was mentally checked out for the holidays, the North Carolina Utilities Commission dropped one of its most important rulings of the last decade, the 137-page Carbon Plan, the Commission's directive to Duke Energy to drastically reduce its carbon dioxide emissions and do its part in thwarting a planetary crisis. However, many clean energy and environmental advocates quickly decried the plan as deferential to the utility. Jim Warren, Executive Director of NC Warren, Duke Energy's perennial nemesis, wrote, "Tragically, the commission went along with Duke Energy's massive climate-wrecking fracked gas expansion. The commission also seemed to go along with Duke's request to greatly limit new solar projects indefinitely, pending billions in new and likely controversial transmission projects. These projects include small modular nuclear reactors, nascent hydrogen power technology, and in additional natural gas resources. The plan is a requirement under House Bill 951, which Governor Cooper signed into law on October 2021. It directs the Utilities Commission to take all reasonable steps to reduce carbon dioxide emissions from Duke Energy's electric generating facilities. The plan sets a goal of 70% reduction in carbon emissions by 2030, just 7 years from now. And by 2050, Duke should have achieved carbon neutrality. The commission has the flexibility to delay these benchmarks by up to 2 years or longer if nuclear or wind power requires more time to be built or to maintain the reliability of the grid. But the planet is out of runway. Globally, the last 8 years have been the warmest on record, according to data released this week by the European Union's Copernicus Climate Change Service. Levels of carbon dioxide and methane continue to increase. The service reported, for both gases, these are the highest concentrations from the satellite record, and by including other records, the highest levels for over 2 million years in carbon dioxide and over 800,000 years for methane. And three of Duke Energy's proposals, prepared in cooperation with public staff, the citizens' representative body that advises that commission, would blow past the 2030 deadline. Quote, while the commission correctly decided not to decide now to extend the 2030 compliance requirement, wrote the Southern Environmental Law Center, it adopted the near-term actions proposed by Duke, which are based almost entirely on plans that missed that deadline. The carbon plan contains other loopholes the size of the Antarctic ozone layer. Environmental justice, for instance, gets short shrift, with just four paragraphs devoted to the issue at the end of the document, as if an epilogue. Environmental injustice is also baked into the rate disparities between Duke Energy Progress, DEP, and Duke Energy Carolinas, DEC. Duke Energy owns both. The cost of electricity, though, is substantially higher by 19% in DEP territory than DEC. Put another way, a household served by DEP that uses 1,000 kilowatt hours per month pays about $126, while the household in DEC using the same amount of energy, $106. That DEP service area encompasses 36 entire counties, of which 21 are designated as Tier 1 by the State Department of Commerce as most distressed economically. Most DEP territory lies along and east of I-95. In comparison, of the 31 countries wholly in DEC territory, just six are Tier 1. Now DEP shares coverage with DEC and another dozen counties, three of which are most distressed. The commission wrote in the plan, the rate difference has increased consistently since Duke and Progress merged in 2012. This is in part because Duke Energy Progress has more solar and needed transmission and distribution upgrades. To address the rate disparity, the Utilities Commission directed that Duke Energy plan to merge its two systems. This would also spread the cost of carbon reduction and new investment over a larger customer base. Because of its geography, flat expanses of land, DE Progress territory will have most of the new solar projects, and customers there, quote, will bear a disproportionate share of the cost to achieve statewide compliance. Duke is scheduled to present merger plans by its next interim carbon plan filing no later than September of this year. Here is an overview of some of the energy sources, both fossil and renewable, that Duke will continue to employ in the coming years. Natural gas, bridge fuel, or planetary assassin? The Commission wrote, the role of natural gas is one of the most significant resource planning decisions in this proceeding. However, methane, the main component in natural gas, is a major driver of climate change, but methane is not accounted for in the plan. That is by design. HB 951 omitted any constraints on methane or natural gas. For its part, Duke countered in the plan that methane and carbon dioxide, quote, are distinct chemical compounds, and had the legislature wanted to include methane, they would have done so. Delaying new natural gas facilities would limit the utility's ability to retire existing coal units, Duke Energy claims. The postponement would reportedly increase carbon emissions by 2 million tons for just one delayed unit. While the Commission did approve natural gas as part of its carbon plan, it cautioned this doesn't mean it's approving the construction of a particular generating facility. In previous commission meetings and filings, Duke Modeling and Near-Term Action Panel said natural gas would help maintain reliability and quality of service. Yet, as North Carolinians now know, several natural gas and coal-fired plants failed during last month's cold snap as instrumentation lines froze. To reduce the immense strain not only on the state grid but on the entire eastern interconnection, Duke had to inflict rolling blackouts on hundreds and thousands of customers on Christmas Eve. There are also limitations on natural gas pipelines. Duke and Dominion canceled the Atlantic Coast Pipeline in 2020, citing enormous cost overruns and successful legal challenges to the project. The Mountain Valley Pipeline, MVP, which is owned by a consortium of companies unrelated to Duke, is similarly stalled in Virginia, in part because hundreds of environmental violations, thus jeopardizing its extension into our state. Duke is assuming no natural gas will be available from the MVP extension, according to the plan. Even if that extension is built, it's uncertain whether the gas can reach DEC territory. According to the U.S. Information Administration, the cost of natural gas is skyrocketing, and Duke modeled its prices before Russia invaded Ukraine, which constricted the supply. The North Carolina Attorney General's office wrote, the dollar figures are now significantly higher than Duke's worst-case scenario in its carbon plan proposal. Solar. Here comes the sun, but it's underwhelming. There is a limited amount of carbon-free and methane-free energy. Fortunately, North Carolina has a lot of it, the sun. When combined with battery storage, allowing Duke to tap into the energy when the sun isn't shining, solar is the cleanest form of power available in the state. The Commission approved Duke's proposed near-term plan, limiting new solar to 3,100 megawatts through 2024, the most utility claims it can interconnect to its system over the next 5 years. Alternative proposals, critics say, were more ambitious and attainable. The Clean Power Suppliers Association, CPSA, wrote, 3,100 megawatts of near-term solar procurement is inconsistent with Duke's own 2030 compliance portfolio, which requires 5,400 megawatts of solar to be online by the beginning of 2030. By lowballing the amount, the Commission has made it extremely difficult to achieve that target, wrote CPSA. However, the public staff contended that figure was unrealistic because of Duke's transmission limits and costs. The staff contended, quote, there must be an orderly transition from fossil fuel to renewable resources, and it faults the CPSA and its contracted modeling for not factoring in greater costs. Wind. It's complicated. Unlike Iowa and Texas, where thousands of wind turbines dot their flat landscapes, North Carolina has just two onshore farms, a 208-megawatt facility in Perkiomen's and Pasquotank counties, owned by Amazon, and the planned 189-megawatt facility in Chowan County, known as Timbermill. Both are in PJM territory, a regional transmission organization, and they're outside of Duke's service area. A previous 18-month state moratorium on wind energy ended in December 2018. Trumpeted by former Senator Harry Brown, a coastal Republican, the moratorium delayed the Timbermill project and derailed progress on developing this renewable resource. It's unlikely that any onshore facility would be built in Duke's energy territory until at least 2029, and then there are hurdles to clear. First, Carteret County has the greatest onshore wind potential, but it also lies within military flight paths, which complicates turbine siting. State law prohibits turbines on mountain ridges, so most blustery western regions are also off-limits. Duke also has transmission constraints in parts of eastern North Carolina. That bottleneck is already limiting the amount of solar that can be passed on to other parts of the state. To accommodate wind power, Duke would have to significantly ramp up its transmission lines. For offshore wind, the prospects are better, although these are long-term plans. In 2017, Avangrid leased federal waters 27 miles offshore of Kitty Hawk, where it plans to build a 2,500-megawatt farm. Transmission requires the installation of undersea cables, and the current route burrows beneath Pamlico Sound, which is likely a deal-breaker. In that case, Avangrid would have to connect onshore at Virginia Beach, adding 100 miles and $350 million to the cost. President Biden revoked the Trump administration's 10-year moratorium on offshore wind leasing in the Southeast, including North Carolina. After the temporary ban was lifted, Duke Energy Renewables Wind successfully bid $155 million for 55,000 acres off Carolina Long Beach in Brunswick County. Total Energies, a French company, won a separate lease in the area. Duke has to provide a site assessment to federal officials by June, with a construction and operations plan due in late 2026 or 27. Considering the 8 to 10 years typically required for an offshore wind farm to begin commercial operation, the Utilities Commission determined that this is a long-term solution, but not a near-term one. Duke is asking the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, NRC, to extend its license for existing nuclear plants in North Carolina. That's Brunswick, Sharon Harris, and McGuire. They're also investigating the feasibility of small modular nuclear reactors. Small reactors are about a third of the size of a typical nuclear power plant. They're housed underground and can be built more quickly and cheaply than traditional reactors. An early version of HB 951 allowed Duke to incur as much as $50 million for an early site permit from the NRC. That provision was later stripped from the measure. However, none of these small reactors currently operate in the United States. NuScale, which builds them, plans to deliver its first one to Utah in 2027. It's not expected to go online until 2029. Even in its infancy, that project has already come in well over budget, from $3 billion to $6 billion, according to a 2020 article in Scientific American. Opponents also question their safety, especially in areas prone to flooding and earthquakes, as well as the disposal of nuclear waste. Scientific American also reported that the NRC itself had safety concerns. One engineer discussed boron dilution, which means even if a reactor is shut down, fission reactions could restart and begin a dangerous power increase. Some clean energy advocates also oppose this technology in the carbon plan because it is unproven and expensive and will generate nuclear waste. Even Duke acknowledged these reactors are not a mature technology and none is commercially operating. To ramp up one by 2032 is an aggressive schedule, reads the plan. Well, now, who pays for the carbon plan? Duke wants to pass costs of the carbon plan along to ratepayers for its initial project development work for the following projects: new nuclear, offshore wind, and pumped hydroelectric power. Current state law allows this early cost recovery only for nuclear plants. Duke warned that without some money up front, it may not pursue some resources. The utility has ample money to pay its top people. CEO Lynn Good raked in nearly $81.5 million between 2017 and 21. Duke's pricing models did not include hefty tax cuts for energy producers that were included in the Inflation Reduction Act. Congress passed and President Biden signed into law the act in August after Duke had completed its modeling. Other federal actions could also alter costs and the overall marketplace. For example, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency is scheduled to propose its revised Clean Power Plan in March. The agency issued a proposal in November that would further limit methane emissions from natural gas operators. That said, the Utilities Commission did approve Duke's proposal to spend roughly $72 million to investigate nuclear power possibilities. But in general, the Commission declined to rule on cost reasonableness and the prudence of carbon plan execution costs until it's formally presented at a hearing. This is not a pre-approval of cost recovery. Duke, not surprisingly, supported the carbon plan as the utility received much of what it requested from the commission, saying in a prepared statement, "We believe this is a constructive outcome that advances our clean transition, supporting a diverse all-of-the-above approach that is essential for long-term resource planning." Clean energy advocates, though, felt deflated by the timidity of the plan, calling the order disappointing. Joel Porter, Policy Director of Clean Air NC, said, "While the plan includes many commendable provisions, it will likely miss the 2030 targets as set out in HB 951. Porter said, "We have to be serious about lowering emissions." That point was underscored by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration this week. "The climate crisis is increasing the chances of extreme weather, such as floods, wildfires, and heat waves. In the first 10 days of 2023, the California coast was drowned in relentless floods, and in Europe, seven countries reported all-time record highs, where midwinter has been as warm as summer." Okay, Jasmine Gallup from the Triangle State of Play. North Carolina may not be the location of choice for the Olympics, at least not yet, but it's about to host the next best thing, the World University Games, an international sports competition for elite college athletes. The games, which occur every 2 years at locations around the globe, involve dozens of countries, hundreds of universities, and millions of tourists who pour into stadiums and arenas across the region to cheer for their favorite athletes. Raleigh Mayor Mary Ann Baldwin made the surprise announcement at a work session last week, just after the International University Sports Federation, FISU, voted to approve North Carolina as the host for the 2029 Summer Games. Baldwin said, "I'm just thrilled. I've been waiting for the announcement to be confirmed. We will have athletes from at least 150 universities throughout the world in Raleigh, Durham, Chapel Hill, and Greensboro. It's a $150 million estimated economic impact. The largest event ever hosted by the state. It is huge." The Triangle Region lost its bid for the 2027 games, but the team's compelling pitch set the stage for this year's victory, said Baldwin. Quote, when we went to Brussels last year, unfortunately, we were not awarded the games in 27, but they hinted to us at that time, what about 2029? I said, you come with the contract, we'll do it. Well, they signed the contract today. Like the Olympics, World University Games has summer and winter competitions for different sports. Winter competition includes skiing, figure skating, ice hockey, while summer gymnastics, swimming, and archery. The summer games have 15 required events, local staples like basketball, track and field, and tennis. FISU, F-I-S-U, could also add three optional events for 29, potentially baseball, rugby, and softball. This year's summer games held in Chengdu, China, are expected to draw some 7,000 athletes who will compete in 18 events over 12 days. The 2029 games in North Carolina are tentatively scheduled for July 13 through 25, but those dates could change, according to Hill Caro, chairman and CEO of North Carolina Bid Committee. This will be just the second time the United States has hosted the summer games. The last competition in the U.S. was in 1993 in Buffalo, New York. The winter games have also occasionally come to the United States. Lake Placid, New York, hosted the 72 games and is hosting them again this year. Student athletes aged 18 to 25 will likely compete in some of the Triangle's best sports complexes, including Wake Med Soccer Park, Cary Tennis Park, and USA Basketball National Training Complex, all in Cary. Over the last two decades, the town has poured more than $20 million into the construction and expansion of world-class sports complexes, drawing the attention of some national and international competition organizers. The Wake Med Soccer Park has been host to international friendlies, as well as professional championships for men's and women's soccer. And, of course, North Carolina is a bastion for college sports. Greensboro is home to the ACC and recently hosted the men's basketball tournament. North Carolina has also hosted the Final Four game once in Greensboro and once in Charlotte. Caro said, as an event that features the best collegiate athletes from around the world, it is a natural fit for a state with 130 colleges and universities and more than 350,000 university students. Like the Olympics, the World University Games requires local officials to join together in a massive organizational effort in the years before the games begin. Host cities are responsible for running the competition according to FISU guidelines, covering the on-site costs of staging the games, accommodating the athletes, coaches, supporting staff, and officials who attend. Guidelines for the games are unique to each city, but do include some general requirements such as paying for insurance and medical care for the athletes and staff. The local organizing committee is also responsible for providing transportation to and from venues, appropriate sites, facilities, materials, and equipment for each event, interpreters for international delegations, and more than 20 guides and manuals for competitors, staff, and attendees, such as the Athletes Village Map and Competition Schedule. In return, the local organizing committee receives the revenue generated by ticket sales, national media coverage, national TV broadcasting, and some national and international marketing and sponsorship. Overall, the games are expected to bring more than $150 million to North Carolina, according to Caro. The chairman compared it to a major corporate relocation, but with the added benefits of significant international tourism and worldwide branding exposure for our state and local communities. And he said, the award is the culmination of an extensive 5-year effort by more than 1,000 individuals, 13 universities, 5 cities, 5 counties, the state of North Carolina, 53 corporate and organizational sponsors to land this amazing event. Arguably, the international exposure bought by the game is just as valuable as the revenue generated. An event like this could put North Carolina on the map as a destination for future sporting events, business headquarters, and tourists. Governor Roy Cooper tweeted last week, "Our state has world-class facilities, a great enthusiasm for college sports, and legendary Southern hospitality that will make these games a success." The games could give North Carolina a unique opportunity to showcase the state, said Secretary of State Elaine Marshall. Quote, "including our renowned universities and all that their great state has to offer to a worldwide audience of more than 400 million. Well, as our time winds down, I will think I can get this last article in about a new show, a new play called Nice White Parents, 2016. Durham playwright Tamara Kassane's controversial new play hits the stage in Greensboro, writes Brian Woods. You probably know people like Cindy and Eric. They're a politically liberal, white, middle-class couple who work from their home in the suburbs of a progressive southern town where their two kids go to local public elementary school. All things considered, they are very nice. And that in itself is the problem in a controversial and award-winning play, Nice White Parents, 2016, by the Durham author and podcast host Tamara Kassane, that sees its first production this weekend in Greensboro. In a sign that regional playwrights are increasing in prominence, Kassane takes the same road west that Mike Wiley took last fall when Greensboro's Triad Stage commissioned and produced Rebellious, a historical drama dealing with the largely behind-the-scenes contributions that students at Bennett College, a black women's college, made to the famous sit-ins in that city. In Kassane's play, the year is 2016. The country's culture and politics are at a fundamental crossroads, as ongoing extrajudicial killings by law enforcement continue to fuel the Black Lives Matter movement. A growing populist and nationalist backlash among right-wing conservatives is ushering Donald Trump into the White House. Locally, when a class of second graders does a march for black lives around their school for a unit on civic activism, a distraught white parent posts a video about it on Facebook. The school is immediately inundated with hate mail, protests, and the teachers receive death threats. It's a moment in which the community needs to take a stand. And when Cindy and Eric are unable at first to decide what that stand should be, and how they should respond, their friendship with Lorraine and Trevor, a black couple, their relationship with their own children, and their own sense of ethics and integrity are all brought into question. In Nice White Parents, 2016, Kassane probes a dilemma similar to one Martin Luther King and others diagnosed in their writings during the 1960s. How white liberals preoccupied more with civility than civil rights have been at times one of the greatest impediments to achieving racial equity in our country. Kassane says it was very uncomfortable to write this. In many ways, it was born out of the discomfort that I felt in 2016, discomfort with my own complicity. In addition to being a longtime actor, playwright, and creator of the Artist Soapbox podcast, who was named Piedmont Laureate in 2020, Kassane was very much a member of the title demographic back in 2016. She says, "I was collecting all these little interactions with people and thoughts I had myself at the time because they really got under my skin. At one point, the material covered her living room floor as she attempted to reassemble, find connections, and make sense of things that were going on at the time for me internally, but also externally in the world." During that time, Kassane recalls seeing a lot of other people who looked like me, struggling with the same issues, and calls her work one way of trying to process, learn, and take responsibility for the discomfort I was feeling and not being okay with staying silent about it. The play caused a sensation when it was submitted to the North Carolina New Play Project, according to Todd Fisher, performing arts coordinator for Creative Greensboro. That's an initiative of the Greensboro city government. And he says, there's this energy when there's four dramatists in the room and they're excited about one script. He remembers the panel feeling, this is hot, this is now. It needs to be seen by a North Carolina audience, and it needs a North Carolina stage. Nice White Parents 2016 isn't the first winner by a regional playwright in the project's 29-year history. Works by Michael Smith, Mary J. Jett Parsley, and Justice Theater Project Artistic Director Jerry Sipp have taken top honors in the past. Winners receive an honorarium, a year of developmental time with feedback from Fisher and Associates, and a public production at the end. With Cassandra, the development process included intense table readings and dialogue with Angela Williams Tripp and Kerry Mubarak, the co-founders of Scrap Metal Entertainment. That's a network of writers, directors, and performing artists, which is co-producing the play. Tripp says the script reveals the subtleties of systemic racism. Tripp says, you're not doing racist things, but you don't realize when you allow someone to do something wrong and you don't step up and say anything about it, you're playing into it. And that's what keeps the circle going. As Cassandra probes into the world of working parents living everyday lives, she parses the privilege that permits the white couple to distance, insulate, and disconnect themselves from the world that the black couple has to navigate directly. As Nice White Parents develops, it becomes increasingly obvious that Cindy and Eric fundamentally do not understand what they've been missing. And I will have to close this article down for now because I've running out of time. Well, I have to cut short, and the cover article in this week, Indie Week, A Prisoner of the Past, about a gentleman named Derek Allen who was declared innocent of rape and is still awaiting compensation from the state for the unfair years of incarceration, quite a few of them. I had to give that up. And also there's an article about the new poet, Dasan Ahanu, appointed as the Piedmont Laureate, second black artist to be named to that post. And those are all available, however, to anyone who wants to pursue these articles by going to indieweek.com and find all of these and those earlier articles I read earlier. So for now, John Feddersen will bring this Indie Week to a close. It's available as a podcast if you go to NorthCarolinaReadingService.com. Thanks all for listening, and I'll probably be back with next week's issue of Indie Week. Bye-bye.